It's bound by time. A person realizes that if all of this that I experience is bound by time, it is not something that I can rely on to give me anything lasting. Because by its very nature, being bound by time, it will come to an end. That has to do with any type of relationship I might imagine, any type of job, any type of sukha, any type of experience, sukha or dukkha, pleasure or pain. It is time bound. And so when a mumukshu has that recognition, it brings about a vairagya, a dispassion. And so with that dispassion, what's behind that dispassion is this. These objects cannot provide me with what I am actually seeking in truth. I'm seeking a state of wholeness, a state of well-being, not a state which is likened to a person in the middle of the ocean being caught by the tide, sometimes being pushed up out of the water and then pulled back down, and pushed up out of the water and pulled back down. That's the example they use in the shastra. Being pushed out of the water, the person has some breath and can breathe and feel so relieved, only to be pulled back down again, to be drowning and suffering, then to be pushed back up, oh, I'm so happy I can breathe, pulled back down, you know, drowning, pushed up again. And after a while, maybe, how many times does it take? You know, how many times does it take before the person says, you know, I would like to be up and stay up. I would like to be able to breathe without the fear of being pulled back down. But there's nothing in the creation that can give me that type of a security. Right? And then a person becomes a mumukshu with a prayer to Bhagavan, if you are there, is there any such state of being that is free from this samsara? Free from this sukha-dukha, 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 sukha-dukha. Is there any such state? And so a mumukshu then, that person who has that, reached that level of understanding or that level of assimilation of experience, then that person becomes what we call an adhikari, somebody who is qualified for what these Upanishads have to teach. Qualified means what? That their mind is available for it. It's not a big qualification in the sense of you're qualified that you're not. I'm sorry, it's not that. It's a personal issue. Whether what the Upanishad is a pramana, which is meant, it's a means of knowledge that's meant to make you see something, to know something. Question is this something that you want to know? Why would you want to know it? Unless you've recognized that there's a problem here in terms of fulfilling myself or fulfilling the human mission, right? The human mission that everybody is seeking to be a whole and a complete person, not the man, not the person drowning in the ocean, right? We're seeking to be kind of lifted up and land on the shore where then I can say, you know, all is well with me. I would like to be able to say all is well with me, and from that stance, be able to experience the sukha and dukkha that the world dishes out. Because the world isn't going to stop. You know, it's not all of a sudden the world is going to stop producing pleasure and pain, or pleasurable situations, painful situations. But I would like to be whole and complete in spite of that, or in the face of that, or in the midst of that. Is there such a reality? Is there such a possibility? And that becomes what the mumukshu is seeking. Now, when such a person is exposed to knowledge, you know, then and exposed to what we call that karma yoga buddhi, means the knowledge itself makes clear what the relationship is, of sukha and dukkha, pleasure and pain, to sense objects. What the relationship, what is the, let me put this in, how the desire template works. The mumukshu who is exposed to this teaching realizes, because it's taught, how the desire template works. The desire template is, I want this in order to be happy. That's the human condition. I want this in order to be happy. If I could put more strongly, I need this in order to be happy. More strongly, I have to have this in order to be happy. So we're familiar with all of this. I want this to be happy. You know, we don't usually add this happy thing. We just take it for granted. I would like this. I want this. I need this. I must have this. If I don't have this, I'm finished. We have all, right? But all of these are just desire templates in terms of my own peace, my own happiness. It's always that I must have this in order to be happy. When I'm exposed to this teaching, what I recognize is that, well, in fact, the ananda or the joy that I experience through the fulfillment of a desire is really only brought about, the experience of ananda is only brought about by the relaxation of my mind. And that relaxation of mind, that quietude of mind, is brought about, of course, by the fulfillment of a desire. Because whenever I fulfill a desire, my mind becomes quiet. And for that moment, you are fulfilled. Every time you fulfill a desire, for that moment, you are desireless. And so...
Sorry.
That is really good. Good music. Okay.
Each time we fulfill a desire.
Thank you so much.
Quiet mind.
Quiet mind. No, I'm there. I know. But sometimes I don't. That's what you said. Every time you fulfill a desire, at that moment your mind is quiet. Anyway, I'm just admiring Kibby. Every time you fulfill a desire, your mind becomes quiet. It becomes desire-free. A desire-free mind is a quiet mind. It doesn't want anything. The only problem is that because you don't know what is actually happening, when the mind becomes quiet and you enjoy the ananda, it's like the reflection of yourself in that quiet mind, you also are experiencing the object of desire. Right? And so the two are superimposed together. So then I think, oh, this object is what makes me happy. Now, when I'm taught, say with the teaching, I actually recognize how this desire template works. I recognize that, in fact, the source of the ananda that I seek in the world is my own being. Right? I understand that. However, because of lifetimes after lifetimes after lifetimes, beginningless lifetimes, of being subject to that superimposition of where the object and the ananda are seen together, whenever a desire is fulfilled, it's hard for me, for the mind, to just say, oh, let's forget all of that the beginningless lifetimes of conditioning, and let me just abide in the truth of myself. And so what we find is a mind that starting to understand, is exposed to this knowledge, right, still habitually is going out into the world, right, and still having needs, in spite of knowing that the ananda that I experience as though from the world is really my own swarupa, it's really my own nature. And all that's required, the only thing that's required for the mind itself, and it's not that I need this for my being, for the Atma, but for the mind to enjoy these variety of bliss states or variety of moments of happiness, moments of joy, moments of compassion, states of well-being, states of mind. Now, states of mind I'm talking about, where the mind feels all is well with me, right? I am happy, I'm satisfied. All that is required has nothing whatsoever to do with objects. It simply has to do with a stress-free, with a relaxed mind. A mind that is not asking objects to make me happy. A mind that is not asking the world to make me happy. If you're asking the world to make me happy, like, say, as soon as I say, I need this to be happy, and I don't have it yet, I need this to be happy, then all innumerable stresses arise. Right? Because the object is away from me, I have to somehow attain the object, and then there's all kinds of obstructions that will come my way. People who don't want me to have the object, other people who I love that do want me to have the object. You know, all kinds, innumerable things get in the way of my fulfilling the desire. And so there's going to be a lot of stress that takes place between me and the object of that fulfillment. But when I do fulfill it, at that moment the mind releases. What if I'm not asking the world to be a particular way? Then the mind is released. Right? But in samsara, because of ajnanam, because of ignorance, when is it that I don't ask the world to be in a particular way? Well, I don't when I get my way. At the moment that I fulfill a desire, at that moment I'm not asking the world to be a particular way, because I just fulfilled the desire, just gotten what I wanted, and nothing has come to interfere with that for the moment. Now, so everybody's had the experience of, okay, I have that joy, or I have that moment of peace, I'm so happy, and then immediately, I'd say really immediately, what, 15 seconds, 30 seconds, maybe it'll last a minute, maybe, between the worry that starts coming about what could take that away, or what could stop that, what could ruin that situation. All kinds of concerns come, even when nothing is coming to ruin the situation. I'm ruining it by my concerns. That's one way that it gets ruined. Another way that it gets ruined is somebody actually does come and ruin it, because that's also a possibility. So this is what we call samsara. Right? But what if I have understood this? No. This is where the karma yoga buddhi comes in, you know, where I start understanding in the light of this teaching. It's a sadhana, it's a way of viewing this creation, it's a way of bringing my knowledge to an understanding of this creation, even though I may have that kartrik form, that doership, that sense of doership, that sense of enjoyership, I have that, you know, but I also am starting to understand the nature of this creation, the nature of the source of Ananda, and starting to see this creation more as Ishwara. Right? So we've been through a lot of this. So we understand this creation more as Ishwara. And I start to recognize that, in fact, this life, from birth to death, is really an expression of my prarabdha karma. In other words, I have a life that is playing out here. Right? And this life that is playing out here is part and parcel of Ishwara. It's part of a much bigger story. And so now I start to, instead of being attached to having this object or that object so that I can be happy, I start instead seeing not being attached to the objects at all. It's not a matter of being attached to the objects anymore. It's really a matter of seeing my life, this life that I'm living, as part and parcel of Ishwara. And everything that I do really is what we call that Ishwara Arpana Buddhi. It's a worship of Ishwara. Everything that I do is a worship, is a recognition of Ishwara. And so I find myself doing my duty. Sao Swamiji would say, I do my duty. What is there before me to do? I do that to the best of my ability. Why do I do that? Because I'm not looking any longer to gain my ananda from objects. I may enjoy objects. Objects come and go. Situations come and go that are pleasurable. That's not the problem. We'll see in the next verse. That isn't going to be the problem. Objects can come and go and they can be pleasurable. I can enjoy the pleasure. But what if I need that object to be giving me the pleasure? That's the problem. I need that. If I need that, that's the problem. Because creation isn't going to stop changing. It's going to be coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. And so I have to have a freedom to allow it to come and go and come and go and come and go. And so how does Bhagavan, the whole Bhagavad Gita, what is his view on this is, you do what is there to be done in terms of your prarabdha. And you fulfill your desires as they present themselves. You go after it. You fulfill your desires. You do your duty. In that, you do your dharma. And you fulfill your desires. You work to fulfill your desires in this world for karma yoga buddhi. But you accept the results of your actions with a prasada buddhi, as prasada from the Lord. Have that attitude. Right? Because that allows you, if you have that attitude, the prasada buddhi attitude, then the world keeps going on and on and on. Right? Your karma keeps going on and on. All of the objects are coming and going. But what you are holding on to is not the object, but it's really your relationship with Ishwara. See what I mean? This whole thing, all of the objects have to do with Ishwara. Your body has to do with Ishwara. Your sense organs have to do with Ishwara. The totality of your experience has to do with Ishwara. And so you have that Ishwara Arpana Buddhi, right, which becomes primary for you. Why does it become primary? Because you know that the source of ananda, right, the source of ananda is the Atma. That's one thing. You recognize the true source of ananda is the Atma. And the relationship of my relationship to Ishwara brings about the shanti, just experientially now that relates, that karma yoga buddhi brings about the shanti, which allows for a peace of mind that isn't disturbed by the world. Right? So that whole karma yoga buddhi, this is the key line, that brings about a peace of mind that's not disturbed by the world. Okay? Because remember, the source of the ananda is the self. And if you have an attitude toward the world, toward your experiences in the world, that are not bound by the fulfillment of a desire, right, because you receive all the fruits of your action as prasad from Bhagavan. If that's the case, if that's the attitude, there's nothing to cause the mind to become stressed. That's the whole thing. Does it cause the mind to become stressed? Your experiences don't cause the mind to become stressed. If the mind doesn't become stressed, it enjoys ananda. So that ananda is going to be relative, because this, on this first line, we're talking about a relative ananda, because we're talking about a state of mind. The karma yoga buddhi brings about a state of mind which is peaceful, that enjoys shanti, that enjoys ananda. And so all that he says here in this first line, a person whose mind is not attached to all of these external objects, I give you kind of the background for that. So the one whose mind is not attached to all of these external objects, sense objects, that person enjoys the sukha, which really comes from the Atma, a sukha that comes from the self. Because the mind is shantavritti, right? There's nothing causing stress in the mind. Now, that's the karma yoga buddhi. That's a state of mind. And it's nice to have a peaceful mind. There's nothing wrong with it. But the jnani has more than a peaceful mind. The jnani has recognized himself, the ananda, which is the very nature of the self, which is present as your being, present to a peaceful mind or a not peaceful mind. That's the Atma. The Atma doesn't require a peaceful mind. But it's very helpful to have a peaceful mind to be able to recognize the Atma in order to gain self-knowledge. You need a peaceful mind. The karma yoga buddhi gives you that shantavritti, right? So it gives you ananda and peace in the mind. But the Atma, yourself, is itself, by its very swarupa, by its very nature, ananda. The ananda which is true to itself, not the different varieties. You look at it like this. It says, akshayam, akshayam, sukham. A sukha which doesn't wax or wane. That's the sukha of the Atma, of the self. That's the happiness, the fullness of the self. It's akshayam. It never changes. Now, look at your states of mind. This looks just a positive state of mind, sukha state. There's calmness, you know, happiness, bliss, joy, love, affection. We have all kinds of different names, right? Compassion. All these are all names that are labeling different varieties of a relaxed mind. Different types of shantavritti. Because in all of these, whether you say joy, compassion, love, friendliness, maitrei, you know, all kinds of friendliness, care, all of these types of emotions have an ananda expressed in the mind. See that? So all of them enjoy a certain peace, a certain relaxation. You can also say, I'm happier, I'm happy. I'm happier than when I was happy. I'm the happiest I've ever been. You know? So there's a gradient. That gradient has to do with the shanta vritti. Vritti means thought modification. That gradient has to do with the different varieties of relaxation in the mind, stress-free in the mind, shanti of peace in the mind. And so for the Karma Yoga Buddhi, there is the basic shanti vritti that has variety. It has some differences in it. The Atma doesn't have variety. The shanti, the ananda of the Atma doesn't become more ananda and the most ananda. And just a little bit of ananda. The Atma is always the same. It's akshayam. It doesn't wax or wane. And so there's a differentiation to be made between the shantivritti that is gained through karma yoga and the shanti that the jnani enjoys. Because the shanti that the jnani enjoys is the shanti of your own swarupa, of your own being, the self that is always present as your being, no matter what the state of mind. When a shantivritti is there in the mind, then your own swarupa is, in a sense, reflecting off of that, you know, reverberating off of that shantivritti. But nevertheless, and so that mind feels very much at home because it feels, you know, it's totally resonant with your own self. So it feels so, you feel so comfortable at home. Like you never say, oh, about a shanta vritti, oh, go away, go away. You'll say that about a dukkha vritti, you know, go, or let me work with you, let me be kind to you, let me do this, let me do that, in order to transform you. Right? Let me transform you. You don't want to, you know, kind of closet it or kick it out. You have a more mature way of, you know, psychologically mature way of dealing with it. Let me work with you so that I can transform you into something that is more harmonious with my being. Right? These are shantivritti. But now, we're always trying to create a shantivritti so that I can be happy. The jnani does not need to create a shantivritti to be happy. Because the ananda of the self is the very truth of the shantivritti or of the sukhavritti or the dukkavritti. Okay? And that's who I am. That's the differentiation that has to be made. It's the recognition of my own presence in whatever mental state is there. Now, of course, when the mind has made that differentiation, the mind relaxes. And so it does have a shantivritti. But in a way, that's wonderful, but that's beside the point. It's relaxing because it's recognized the self, which is not going to go away. it's recognized that the ananda that I need in order to be whole is my own being, and that being me is not going to go away, run away, or change from me, change, you know, or can't escape from me, nor can I escape from it. One recognizes it can't leave me, nor can I leave it. So in the Upanishad it says, forget which one, maybe it's got them. If I send my mind to the moon, you know, I'm already there before my mind gets there. Right? There's nowhere the mind can go. Send my mind to the moon, I'm there before it gets there. I send it to the end of the creation, I'm there before the mind gets there. There's nowhere the mind can go. There's no emotion that the mind can have. There's no situation at all. No emotion, no thought, no travel, nowhere the mind can go that I'm not already there. And so when the mind, and I am the very source of the ananda, so when the mind recognizes that, it's free. It's free because I am free and I am its very self. Right? And so here it says, the first line is for the mind enjoys that sukha-vritti for the karma-yogi. But the second line is for the one who has recognized I am Brahman. That one recognizes a sukha, an ananda which is akshaya. Because that ananda doesn't wax or wane. That ananda that I am, that wholeness that I am, the me, the my very being, we need to differentiate that. And this is a really good sadhana. It's a good exercise to do. To differentiate that, when you're having an experience of joy or happiness, say your child smiles, and it just gives you an experience of peace, an experience of joy. Somebody tells you a joke and you laugh. Your mind has a shantavritti. And the mind has that shantavritti and you're feeling at peace and happy and all is well. So that time to do that differentiation between the happiness, the fullness of the mind, the happiness of the mind, and then notice the conscious being that you are, the me, your own presence, and see the difference. Because one is a reflection, in a sense, but one is you. One is you. You are the one there that is full and complete and changeless. The reflection is something slightly different, you know. And so to make that differentiation is a wonderful thing to do. And you do that with reference to a shantavritti, then when you have a dukkavritti, you know, say you have some sort of sorrow or pain or hurt, then sit with that and then again become aware of the me, of your own self that is present to the dukkha-vritti, and see if they're not the same. You see they're exactly the same. The shanti, ananda of the self, does not require a sukha-vritti or a dukkha-vritti. We prefer the sukha-vritti. Dukkha-vritti is painful, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the ananda of yourself, your own presence, that is there, illuminating and pervasive to the dukkha-vritti, as much as it is there, illuminating and pervasive to the sukha-vritti. That is Brahman, that is the self. And so, the jnani, the Brahma-yoga-yuktatma, the jnani is the one who is that self. When the ahankara, the I notion comes up, it resolves into that atma, which is always the same. It never varies at all. And so, the mind that is awake to that, right, that mind feels free, not because it's free, it's nitya after all, it's always changing and whatnot, but its being is free. The atma, the self itself, its very self is free. And the mind can't be away from that free self. And so there the mind, of course, it does change over time. It changes and it transforms because the problem is solved. The problem of the search for ananda is solved for the mind. And so the mind relaxes and revels in that ananda. And that ananda is akshaya, and it doesn't wax or wane, it never changes. So, let's go to the next verse. Yogi Sanskarsita Bhogaha Yehisam Parishadabhoga Dukha Yonaya Evate Dukha Yonaya Evate Ardhan Savanta Kaunteya
Ardhan Savanta Kaunteya
Yate Shura Mate Buddha
Yate Shura Mate Buddha
Yehi Samsparsha Jaha Samsparsha Jaha Bhogaha Dukha Yonaya Evate Ardhan Savanta Kaunteya Na Teshu Ramate Buddha. He says, Yehe, Ye, Namat of Pearl, indeed he. Samsparisha Jaha Bhogaha. Those enjoyments, Bhogas, those enjoyments, Namat of Pearl, which are Samsparisha Jaha, born of sense contact. Sparisha reaches the contact. So those that born of sense objects, sense perception, sense objects, just say sense objects. So those bhogas that are in, that are born of sense objects, dukha yoniyaha evate, they are sources of dukkha. Right? They are sources of dukkha. Yoniyaha is from yoni, namas of plural. Yoni means a womb. Means these enjoyments that are born, these pleasures that are born out of your sense contact, they are wombs for dukkha. Means they're going to give birth to dukkha. Why will they give birth? Why are they wombs of dukkha? Means that they're the source of dukkha. They're going to produce, they're going to give birth, they're going to result in dukkha, in sorrow. Why? Adi Antavantaha. Because they have a beginning and end. Adi is beginning, Anta is end, but affix means possessive, the nominative plural. So Adi Antavantaha, like Bhagavantaha. So these bhogahas that are born of sense enjoyment, sense objects, they are going to give birth to dukkha. Why? Because all of them have a beginning and an end, right? They're born and they die. But hey, Kaunteya, Bhokara, son of Kunti. Na teshu ramate buddha. Buddha, the one who has knowledge, the jnani. Na teshu ramate. The jnani doesn't revel, doesn't revel teshu in them, right? The jnani, the buddha, the wise person, doesn't revel in them. The wise person doesn't seek enjoyment. That's not what they're looking for their ananda, for their fullness. If enjoyment comes, that's fine. If some pleasure, that's another thing to understand. It isn't about running away from sense objects. It's not that. It's not also running away from the sukha, the small pleasures, you know, the world, small and big pleasures that the world has to give, the pleasurable situations. It's not about running away from them, you know, but it's about having that mindset where I need this to be happy. If I can enjoy it when it is there and be fine when it leaves, that's not a binding desire, right? That desire template has become nitya. It's become what we call bodhita. It's become sublated. It's like this. This is the desire template. I need this to be happy. Right? That's the full desire template. Now, if that's the truth, if that's my truth, then that's a binding desire. But if I don't need this to be happy, then I can enjoy it as it is. When it comes, I can enjoy it. When it goes, I can enjoy it. The example Swamiji always uses is the helium balloon. The helium balloon, you know, for a child. We've all had them, I'm sure. Helium balloon for a child. You know how it always somehow slips out of your hand at some point. Okay? And for a child, it can be a tremendous loss. Right? It's gone. And it, even if it doesn't go, if you've seen them shrivel, poor thing.
It deflates,
you know. Something happens to the darn thing, you know. So the helium balloon doesn't have a very long lifespan. And that's why it's always used for an example. The helium balloon is going to go. And that can send a child into just a terrible state of sorrow. Right? But normally for an adult, for most adults, at most times, if you get a helium balloon also, now you and your child have the helium balloon, and yours happens to break loose, then you can enjoy it as it rides up into the sky. You know, chances are very great that you're not going to be grieving over its loss. That's vairagya. That is what we mean by vairagya or dispassion. It's not that I can't have fun with a helium balloon. It has nothing to do with being able to not being able to enjoy the helium balloon. It's that I can enjoy it while it's there, and I can let it go when it's gone. That is vairagya. That is a non-binding desire. And so here when it says, the Buddha, the wise person, doesn't revel in these objects, the meaning is this full desire template, where I'm seeking out of the world. I'm seeking the world to be in a particular way so that I can be happy. I need the world to gratify me. I need this situation to be like this so that I can be happy. I need to go have this kind of fun so that I can be happy. I need to do this so that I can be happy. I have to construct my happy moments out of the world. And Jnani doesn't have to construct the happy moments out of the world. I am happy and I enjoy the world. It's very different. It's not that I need to get world happiness out of the world. I am happy. I am happy because I'm the source of the ananda that's ever existed in the entire world. The world doesn't have any ananda. I'm the ananda that the world has. If the world has some ananda, just imagine it. One object, say, here it is. This is it, folks. This is the ananda object. Just stands for anything. This is the ananda object, you know. Now, if this is the ananda object, we all will want this, right? And it will. Not only will we all want it because ananda, we will want it all the time, and all the time it will be giving us ananda also, because it is the ananda object. There is no such object. In fact, every object in the creation, so take any given object that we're used to, any object can make me happy, you miserable, and somebody else totally indifferent, right? We usually use that example in reference to relationships. You know, my relationship, say, if Swamiji always uses the example of imagine a party, like somebody's having a party. Everybody seems to be having a really wonderful time, kind of schmoozing and talking to each other, and there's 20, 30 people at the party. And all of a sudden, some guy comes in, he's looking around, and over in the corner, his ex-wife spots him. He's entered, and she thinks, oh my God, I didn't know this guy was coming. I never would have come if I knew he was going to be here. Now what am I going to do? And she starts getting very, very kind of upset and kind of embarrassed and awkward and wondering how she's going to make this. And how did this jerk come? So it starts building up. Right? But on the other side of the room, you know, there's another woman who sees him, and she gets so happy and so excited because this is her new guy, her new fiancé. And she waves to him, and she feels ecstatic, while this poor woman on this side is feeling absolutely miserable. And of course, there's another 20 people in the room who could care less. For to them, this guy doesn't even exist, right? Okay, so now we have it. The same poor man, okay, is making somebody absolutely miserable. Same person. Somebody miserable. 20 people, no reaction. Another person, so happy. It's one man. Okay, so now, of course, the story doesn't end there. So now this guy goes over, he sees his new girlfriend and walks over, and they're having a wonderful conversation. She's so happy that he's come, and they're just so in love. Everything's wonderful. And he decides he's going to go get them a drink, and as he turns around, he's all be back, right back, and they give him a drink. But as he turns around, he sees his ex-wife there, and when he sees her, he feels some affection. He doesn't have the same reaction to her as she's having. He's feeling, oh, I haven't seen her for so long. And then he feels some sort of nostalgia or something and decides to go over and talk to her. And feeling kind of warm, he walks over with kind of a warmth and a smile and says, and approaches her, and she's thinking, what's he doing coming over here? He approaches. And she starts to, just by the look in his face and his warmth, and he says something really kind to her, like, I really missed you, how are you, or something like that. She starts kind of just melting a little bit. And they start having a conversation. And she starts laughing, and then they start instead of enjoying each other, much to her surprise. But she's melted a little bit and enjoying him. And now, of course, the fiancé is noticing this, noticing it, and she knows, of course, that this is the ex-wife, and she's seen them really, you know, years of familiarity and kind of enjoying each other, and she's starting, all of a sudden, her happiness is dripping off, and she's starting to become very kind of unhappy. And so now we've kind of changed the role. And of course the other 20 people are still totally indifferent. But you know, see, this is the thing though. If the happiness belonged to the object at all, first of all, it would make everybody happy because it is happiness. This object is happiness. But we don't have that experience with any object. Every single object that we've ever experienced, whether it be a human being or an animal or an inert object, doesn't make any difference. Every single object can have the capacity to at some time make me happy, at another time make me sad, at the same object, at another time make me totally indifferent. And not only that, that same object, when it's making me sad, can make somebody else miserable.
What's going on?
The same time, somebody else miserable, and most people totally indifferent. If that's the case, there is nothing there. There is no ananda there. It has nothing. In the whole universe, that is the condition of the entire universe. No ananda. It has nothing to do with ananda. They are just names and forms. Right? The ananda has a different source. Right? So that this is the grand illusion. In fact, I am the ananda. The source of the ananda is the atma, it's the self. When the mind is relaxed, it is in a condition that is in total harmony, resonating with my own being. Okay? Reflecting my being, kind of like they use the example of if I have the sun shining down in three water buckets, clear water buckets, the sun is reflecting beautifully. That water bucket is so happy. Okay. Same sun shining on a muddy water bucket. The reflection is very muted. Same sun shining in a rippling water bucket. The sun seems to be breaking up. Right? Those are all vrittis, those are all states of mind, right? And so, when I don't recognize that I am the sun illumining all of the water buckets, if I don't recognize my own swarupa, my own nature, then the mind, all the mind is doing is seeking to resonate with the sun, right? It's only seeking to take on a condition which resonates with me, with my own being. And the fulfillment of a desire gives me that clear water bucket, where then I can feel happy. But when something goes wrong in the creation, the water bucket, the vrittis, get anxious or tense. like in this scenario, when the ex wife sees, you know, her ex coming in, immediately the water bucket, the mind, you know, gets very tense. It creates pain. For the other woman, it becomes a combination between the still mind and the ripply mind, kind of like a, you know, what do you call that? Manic state. It's kind of manically happy. Right? Those are all of the different variations. But for the jnani, I'm not the reflection in the clear water, and I'm not the reflection in the muddy water, and I'm not the reflection in the agitated water. I'm the sun. I'm the conscious being that is there as the very self, the very conscious me, the very presence. That's the truth illumining all three different conditions. And so I recognize myself, and my mind has differentiated itself, the mitya, the different conditions of the mind, from the stable presence of me. That's the ajnana belongs to the mind, knowledge belongs to the mind. Right? The mind is the one that's suffering. So that suffering because it hasn't had any differentiation between the stability of my own presence, my own non-ananda, my own fullness, and its condition. Because it doesn't have that viveka, that differentiation, it is dependent on its condition. It must be like the clear water bucket in order to be happy. But the jnani doesn't really even think that way, because no matter what its condition, I am its truth and I am stable. So the stable self is the one that's filling whatever the vritti is. Of course, that allows, as I said, that allows for the vritti to, the thought modification, the type of the mind, to relax. And so that's why here, the jnani does not revel in the sense objects. Because the reveling is in, the commitment is in self. Now the commitment is to the self. The commitment, let me put it this way, the commitment is to the ananda, to the wholeness which the mind enjoys. Right? The wholeness which the mind enjoys is the Atman. And so the mind is reveling in the Atman, not in the object. See, this Ramate means reveling. So the mind is reveling in the Atman, in the Ananda. This is a nice way to say it. The mind is reveling in the Ananda, not in the object. If it's reveling in the object, then it's totally dependent on that object being in relationship with it in a particular way that will allow the mind to be quiet so that the mind can reflect the ananda, so that then I can say this object is making me happy. You understand? But the jnani doesn't go through this circuitous route at all. So the jnani's mind, the mind revels in the ananda, not in the object of which on which the ananda had been superimposed. And so then if I'm reveling in the object, that I need to attain the object to my satisfaction so that my mind will be relaxed, so that I can enjoy the ananda of the relaxed vritti. Rather than for the jnani is reveling in the ananda itself, not in the object which you have superimposed the ananda on. That's the whole thing. That's why this ramate is a good word to use. Yeah. Because in fact, we are all reveling in the ananda, not in the object. We don't really care about the object. We care about the ananda that the object is supposed to be providing. Mm-hmm. As soon as the object stops providing the ananda, we don't want that object anymore. Mm-hmm. But we're very fickle that way. You can say, even for your partner, your beloved, you can say, you know, you can be totally in love with that person, but then they're not behaving in the way they're supposed to. And so they're causing you pain. And so you can say and you can feel, you know, I want you back in the way that you're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want you in this form.
Mm-hmm.
Say if I'm not saying I want, I'm not saying I want to divorce you. I'm just saying, not in this form. I don't want you in this form, because when you're in this form, I'm not happy.
Mm-hmm.
So I love you, but not in this form. Right? So please change so that I can be happy. Okay? That's the supreme, that's all the superimposition. If my mind is instead reveling in the ananda, then I am happy. Right? Because my mind is reveling in the ananda itself. And then you be as you are. How you are, then that's what I have to deal with, good or bad. Right? You be as you are. Because they are going to be as they are anyway. But you can say for the world, you know, the world, you be as you are, and then I have to deal with you. And I do my best. That's the song she says. And moment after moment, I just do my best. But I deal with it. I do the best that I can. Moment after moment after moment. You know, I do my part. I do my duty. But I'm not doing it for ananda. I'm doing it out of ananda. The mind is enjoying ananda. I do my duty. Enjoying ananda, I appreciate my relationship with you. You know, it's so different.
Mm.
So different. It's so freeing. And so here in this verse, we'll wind up here. He's just saying that he's just making clear the negative. The recognition of the negative in terms of commitment to the object. The objects are sources, are the wounds for sorrow, because they have a beginning and they have an end. No object ever stays the same. The object itself will come and go, and then while the object is here, it will change. And not only will it change, your relationship to it will change. You know, like something that you absolutely love, you become bored with and it ends up at the garage sale. It's an amazing thing. Something that you love, all precious things, but you just have too much stuff, it's time to feng shui. Time to, you know, get rid of some of these things. And so these things that used to be dear to me, books, everything, you know, gone. Right? It's over. It's over. That's the reality of objects. And so, but these objects can be great sources of sorrow also, because they can also walk out on you when you need them. They can act in a way, when you need them to be in one way, they act in another way. Yeah? When you need them to love you, they decide they don't love you anymore. And that's a horrible thing. Yeah? I love you, I need you, my life depends upon you. The other person looks at you. I'm sorry, you know, but it's over. In fact, they want a divorce.
Amazing,
you know. But these are just, it's a very strange situation. I mean, human relationship really gives it, really talks it to us in terms of pain, you know. I'm in love with you, you're not in love with me, unrequited love. Mm-hmm. It never works out like this. We're both in love with each other, and now all of a sudden, we're both not in love with each other. That would be okay. We love each other. No, we don't need to love each other. All exactly the same time.
That's good timing.
Yeah. No, we don't love each other, and we both want to just be independent, and we shake hands, and we go our own way. That is like one of those dreams. Doesn't make a good movie. Okay, let's go.
What was that word again?
Remedy?
Yeah.
It means to revel. To revel in something.
Yeah. when we visit the temple, you experience shanti. Is that from the self or is it from the temple?
It's from the self.
Oh, it's from the self.
There is no, you mean shanti, you mean the ananda?
Yeah.
Yeah. The ananda is the self. That is the self. Ishwar's ananda.
Then how come you experience it when you go to the temple?
Because your mind becomes quiet. Shraddha.
Oh.
That's why. Mm-hmm. When you go to a temple, of course the temple, there's also certain grace in the temple also because so much prayer has been done there, so there's an instant energy. But also, if you've ever been to a temple, it's even true, and if you've ever gone to any of the cathedrals also in Rome, they also have very, very absorbing, there's certain energy there, there's so much prayer. But that energy and that prayerful, you're in Shraddha, makes the mind become very quiet. And sometimes it can very like in a meditative state, very, very quiet, and you see all the wholeness and the ananda. Somebody might necessarily not feel that if they didn't have Shraddha and then wanted to be someplace else.
So it gives a deep, very profound,
holy atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
You go to a place where there's been a tremendous amount of prayer. Yeah, and the place has been held as sacred, then that place becomes sanctified.
Mm-hmm.
And you can feel the sanctity of the place.
Yeah, because that's what they do there.
Yeah.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you also are going into it without expectation. There's two things. I mean, there's a real energy, just a continual prayer and rituals and things being done in the same place over many centuries even. And then there's also your own attitude that when you go into a sacred place, it brings it about a great deal of peace. The same thing, you know, like if you meditate together, if you do a group meditation, everybody is going into that, you know, meditative space, and that creates a meditative energy that
mm-hmm.
makes that meditation deeper for, can make that meditation deeper for everybody. Just so, I mean, we affect each other. You know, just in a simple way, if somebody who's very peaceful and happy and full comes into a room, you will kind of, everybody else will be affected by that presence.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if conversely, if somebody who's very, very angry and hostile comes into a room, also, it affects, everybody's affected by it. So we affect each other. We don't really necessarily, we realize that other people affect us, but we don't necessarily realize that we affect other people. But we do. And so when you have, say if you're doing contemplation or you're in a sacred place in your temple or something, you know, that you're affected by the energy of that place. I think in Coimbatore, the temple of Coimbatore has a very sacred energy. There's been so many, the place was built really following all of the Vedic specifications perfectly, and all the proper pujas, everything has been done properly. And then day after day, you know, the full pujas are done in the morning and the evening. They're all done very, very traditionally. You know, so you feel that what's being evoked in that temple is very, you've been.
Is that the one on top of the hill?
No, that was wonderful too. There's one. There's
the street.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of Mamukshas have come there too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and Yanis.
Yeah, that temple, but it's so wonderful to go to their puja in the morning is about 2 hours. So they do so many chants, so many things are just really beautifully done. And then it's now another hour and a half in the evening, and then throughout the day there's smaller things that are done. But that's done that year after year after year, every single day. And so now that temple, because it's so traditional, it's actually gaining a reputation around India among people who care about that type of thing. People will go to that temple because to pray and to ask Bhagavan for help in this way or that way, because it evokes some certain sanctity.
There's also the piece of Seva that like in a sacred place people are offering without greed, without...
Yeah. Shraddha. Right. That's why they say when karma yoga, what is the example they use is prasada buddhi. Prasada buddhi is when you go to a temple and after the puja has been done, the pujari will bring out the prasada. It could be to offer to everybody, right? It could even be just the buddhi ash or some chandan, or it could even be some water or a leaf or some flowers. Or it could be a whole meal. It could be anything. But whatever it is, the attitude with which you take that is one filled with shraddha, as though you're being given prasad, you know, from the Lord, from Bhagavan. And so we say the karma yoga buddhi is that prasad of buddhi. Whatever it comes in terms of that's being given to you in terms of the karma phala, you accept with that prasad of buddhi. It's coming from Ishwara. That's the Ishwara arpana buddhi. It actually is Ishwara. It's not coming from somebody else. There is not anybody else. So everything that's coming to you is coming from Ishwara. So as long as the karpit for the jiva, there's a karpit from bhokta from its dualship and ishwarship, it's all part of the jnana. But Krishna will say, you keep your karpit from bhokta from for the time being, and your dualship, your enjoyership. That's all right. That'll go away in time. Just understand, just accept all of the fruits of your action. You go ahead and be the actor, but realize that all of the results of your actions come from me. Receiving all from me. I'm the karma phala data. I'm the giver of the karma phala, the fruits of the action. You do the action, but I give the fruits. And then as you gain knowledge, you realize that the karta and bhokta also are Ishwara. Yeah. But initially, just see, this is, accept all of the fruits of that karma as coming from me.
Karta
is the doer,
okay.
Bhokta is the enjoyer.
Yeah. That being said, indicates also that when one is involved in a project, when one is doing something,
yeah.
One, there is that tendency to become attached to the results or to think that the results are from my doing.
Right. But that's why, you know, they say for a mumukshu, somebody who's wanting to gain knowledge, you keep doing shravana. You keep listening, you know, and studying, and you live in the world. You live in your world and work those things out. Right? Because that doership and enjoyership is ingrained. I mean, I take myself to be an individual, you know, in a kind of a concrete world. I'm an individual and a conscious being in this human world. I don't see that this whole creation is an expression of infinite knowledge. And that this body, mind, sense organs is a part of that. Rather, I see that I am a conscious being in this unconscious world. Unconscious little light bulbs. You know, like here's, what, 10 conscious beings, you know, living, existing in this unconscious room. Right? And so I have to make my way in this unconscious world. I have to do it. You know, I don't recognize that this is a conscious world, that this is Ishwara, and that this body, mind, sense organs is part of Ishwara. So I don't understand that I'm part of a bigger play, part of a bigger picture, and that I'm actually responding and within this bigger picture. I think the picture is the mirror, and I'm the conscious being in it, and God is up there watching somewhere. Who knows what we think, you know?
Someone with a young degree of mind doesn't think that way.
No. It's not as though you totally, if you've got a body-mind sense organs, you still have the I thought, you still have a sense of doership, a sense of enjoyership, but you recognize all of that as existing, as mithya, as existing within this, within Ishvara. And you also recognize the changelessness of yourself.
You recognize it not just from the mind, but there's also some intellectual recognition.
The mind recognizes it, but what is an intellect? The mind knows it and has seen it. But yourself is not dependent upon the mind seeing you. Yourself is self-evident. It's just that that self-evident self has been mistaken by the mind to belong to it. Right? So the mind says, I am the self. But in fact, the mind can come in, the mind is the self in a sense, like the pot is the clay. But the self is not the mind. The mind totally depends for its being on the self, but the self doesn't depend for its being on the mind. Right? Like the pot depends upon the clay for its being, but the clay doesn't depend upon the pot. Or the snake depends upon the rope for its being, but the rope doesn't depend upon the snake. It's rope, snake, itself. And so I need to recognize that's the satyam mithya. Satyam means that which is true, which is real, versus that which depends upon it for its reality. Mithya depends on what is real for its reality. There is no pot. There's only clay there. The pot depends 100% on the clay for its being. The mind depends 100% on the Atma, on the self, for its being. But the self doesn't depend on the mind at all. The self is a changeless presence that fills the mind and everything else for that matter, the me. But that relationship has to be seen by the mind. But the mind is not what gives you the self-experience. I am the self-experience. So I don't need the mind to give me the self-experience at all. I just need the mind to gain knowledge so that it doesn't usurp the self-experience to itself. Mm-hmm. See what I mean? Yeah.
And when would you say that the doership and enjoyership, when would you see that as Ishvara? Yeah.
You see it all as Ishvara when you recognize that you're the changelessness of your being. When you recognize the changelessness of your being, just that to me, then all of this, you know, belongs to Ishvara. So that it all comes with all of the different teaching methodologies that kind of release yourself, you know, from belonging to the body or belonging to the sense organs or belonging to the mind. By belonging to the mind means that the mind is not, I'm not. Body is not, I'm not. Right? It's called Anvaya Vyatireka. To show whether this little piece of logic shows an invariable relationship. It goes like this. When the one is, the other is. When the one is not, the other is not. Like for instance, if I feel like this. When the sun is, the day is. When the sun is not, the day is not. You can't have day without sun. The two are totally dependent upon one another. So now what if I were to say, when the mind is, the self is. When the mind is not, the self is not. That's an invariable relationship, and there's total dependence there. But in fact, what we say is, when the mind is, the self is. When the mind is not, the self is. That's the independence. Right, so we could say, we use this Anvayavyatireka in this life, we'll say, when the waking state is, the self is. When the dream state is, the waking state is not. Right? So when the waking state is, the self is. When the dream state is, the self is. But the dream state has negated everything that's in the waking state. In terms of experientially, just think of it. If I have a dream, What has been displaced in the waking state is not only everything I experienced, but the experiencer. The body, the mind, the sense organs, the ahankara, the I notion, and the world of experience is displaced by the dream. In the dream, I have a different world, a subtle world, subtle body, could be in a different body, or no body. Right? So we say, the waking state is, the self is, yes. The dream state is, which negates the waking state, the self is. The deep sleep state is, which negates both the waking and the dream state, the self is. And so what we say is the self is, just in that, using waking, dream, deep sleep, the self is what we call the anuvritti. The anuvritti is that which goes all the way through, right? It goes all the way through all three states, even though these states of experience negate each other. And so waking, dream, deep sleep is very useful for ferreting out yourself. And other things you can look at, like, for instance, the dream. When you have a dream, right, you are. When you wake up from just a dream alone, you have a dream, you are. It's my dream. I'm pervasive, just dream. I am there. And I can be identified with the character in the dream or not. Now, what's interesting is, when I wake up from the dream is gone. The dream universe is gone. Dream characters are gone. If I'm identified with a character, that character is gone. Nothing has happened. Nothing has happened to me at all. This is a phenomenon when you really think about it. The dream universe goes absolutely zero. Nothing has happened. This is exactly where the experience that universe, the universe goes, say the dream goes or the universe goes, doesn't make any difference. Right? Because I'm not either one. Right? I'm no more than this physical universe. There's still the direct issue that see or seen differentiation can show how that I'm no more this physical universe, this physical body, this physical sense organs, this whole manifest infinite Ishwara. I'm no more that, the Atma, then I am the dream world. Then I am the waking world. That's why these things can come and go irreplaceably. It makes no difference. There's nothing that happens to me. Now that same constancy of myself, you can recognize just here in this world itself. Not bothering about the dream or the deep sleep. Just from thought to thought to thought. Emotion to emotion to emotion. Experience to experience to experience. These experiences, once the experiences negate each other, moment to moment, one moment negates the prior moment. One thought negates the prior thought. One emotion negates the prior emotion. All these things have a beginning and an end.
Mm-hmm.
They all are coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. But they're coming and going, coming and going in me who is absolutely and remains absolutely untouched. So this untouched one, the me, the untouched me, that is the truth of all this coming and going, is what I need to recognize. That's knowledge. And that's the one that is free, the one that's not coming and going, that is not touched. That's the Atma. And that self is the truth of all that is coming and going. That's what's more than
associated with the Atma or with the
Ahamkara? Atma. It's just only to show that itself, the embodied information, I say, the waking state is, the Atma is, so it's present. When the dream state comes, it negates the waking, but the Atma is not negated. Mm-hmm. Right? That's not the Ahamkara. The Ahamkara that is there in the waking state cannot be there, need not be there in the dream state. Be a different ahankara.
Mm-hmm.
And in the deep sleep state, there's no ahankara. Ahankara means I notion. But in the deep sleep state, there's no ahankara, there's no subject object, there's no world. Right? That's another strange thing. Don't you think that would be kind of frightening? You should go to sleep, you know. And not only does the world disappear, but you disappear in terms of your body, your mind, your sense organs. Just nobody saying, oh, look, I'm deep sleeping, isn't that interesting? So the whole mind goes into an unmanifest condition. And you know what? You're just completely fine with that, in fact. So I'm dealing with the whole story, you know, about how getting all of these nice pillows and, you know, silk sheets and comforter and all of that, and you know, you get your room all nice and all cozy, and you just climb in to your bed and pull the comforter up, and all pillows around you, and you just enjoy going into absolute oblivion. You look forward to it. That's because the self is ananda.
I wonder whether, because kids at a certain age are afraid to go to sleep and all of that kind of story and all of that, I wonder whether that coincides with them learning the notion of I am the waking state, and so they're afraid.
Or afraid of the dark.
Or that.
For being alone. I think there's a lot of reasons for being afraid. And a lot of it has to do, I think, with fear of the boogeyman and fear of the dark. There could be other reasons too.
What do you mean? Just light stays on in the room, which sometimes you do for
a long time. Oh, yeah, a little night light.
You said when you go to sleep, that is ananda, but that's no less ananda than when you're awake.
But no, but there's nothing blocking, right? The mind isn't interfering.
Right.
So that's always your joke sometimes, say, you know, ignorance, total ignorance is bliss. Because everything is just in unmanifest condition, so there's nobody causing you any problems at all. So there's just your being, but the mind is in a state of total ignorance. Right? So that's a little different than a nirvikalpa samadhi or something like that, because the mind is in unmanifest, what we call an avyakta condition. Do you like that?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody would love to see
you. Hey, Karen, you said something like, Swamiji said, you're doing duty out of ananda, not for ananda. You know? Duty.
Your life is out of ananda, not for ananda. Yeah.
Yeah, and I wanted to know, because that seems like a profound insight, you know, in terms of orientation in this whole drama. And does a mumukshu already get that in the deepest sense, what that really means? Is that
you keep
that
getting it,
or
you,
that
you get it when you recognize yourself.
Right, so I wanted to know, so because I'm trying to kind of understand where the shift in consciousness between the mumukshu and the jnani.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it that the mumukshu hasn't quite embraced in his understanding to the jnani? What is that piece? Because there's already this movement happening. Is that just, and we talked about that, I remember some other time ago, but is there a certain kind of, is it just that the jnani has reached a certain kind of maturity and fullness where that understanding is that I am the self is fully established, or is it actually other components of understanding that the mumukshu doesn't have that the jnani does have?
I think there's components of understanding, because the identification with the mind is so thorough that to recognize that the me that is always there is actually free of the mind, and that's what we're talking about. Because there's always some identification with the state of mind,
mm-hmm.
and not with just the self. And at some point you recognize the self, that you are that self. And that's just totally different. Then you recognize, and I'm always here. Nothing ever happens to me. It has nothing to do with the mind. I have nothing to do with the mind at all. That's the recognition. And that recognition, once you have that recognition, it's very obvious. But until you have it, it's just a subtle shift that has to take place, and it takes place when it takes place. until then, there's looking for states of mind. You know, mm-hmm. dependence upon the Shantavritti and all of that. You know, like when my mind is happy or at peace, then I can see myself. I need a peaceful mind to see myself. What that means is that I'm equating myself with the peaceful mind.
So the mumukshu is still looking for that.
He's still looking for that.
So that's what I meant. So the mumukshu is looking for ananda in the duty.
Right? Mm-hmm. No, I don't think so. Yeah. I think that they're just doing that the karma yoga because that takes the mind so close in terms of attitude to the mm-hmm. attitude of a jnani. And so it brings about a simple, uncomplicated mind mm-hmm. that is available for this teaching,
mm-hmm.
right? And that, it just brings a peace to the mind and an availability, because actually the mumukshu is the one who's trying to gain knowledge. That karma yoga buddhi gives the mind a peace and availability to this knowledge. And then the knowledge has to do its job.
Mm-hmm.
And then after some point, once you know, you do know yourself, then that karma yoga buddhi is useful for just breaking this emotional lag time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because you've spent beginningless lifetimes in samsara without identification, and so the mind habitually behaves in a particular way. And so those certain attitudes help it, and your knowledge helps to bring the mind in, you know. For a while.
So then, is it the step change or this paradigm shift that you spoke of?
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible to have that knowledge, but because of this habitual error, or because of the lifetime of the work that you've done in karma yoga, it like takes a while to penetrate, or?
That's right, it does. It takes a while for the habits and all of the kind of orientation to drop off or to transform. But you still know, and you're still behaving like an ajnani. And then you just help your mind, you realize that you know, different parts of your mind, it takes time because there's so much network. It's such a huge, vast network. You know, and actually it really helps to be kind of compassionate toward the mind, to give the mind a chance to assimilate this knowledge. It takes place over time, in spite of your knowing. Yeah. Like somebody who really understands it can say, you know, I know I don't act like I know, but I know.
So, I mean, this is a slightly different question, but I mean, just a question about how to understand Ishvara properly. So,
yeah.
Is it something like, so for example, when I relate to you or anybody else, I don't look at you as just some collection of thoughts and cells. I look at you as a person and I relate to
right.
you that way.
Right.
So if I were to sort of relate to the whole world, like everything is sort of a person. And then I would sort of call that person Ishvara. So whenever I get something from the world, I don't look at it as an inert thing giving me something, but like this person. So is that sort of the
understanding? Yeah, Ishvara is more than, it's a person, but it's like the Purusha. It means this whole infinite creation is an infinite being. And so in that way, Ishvara is a person. You do see everything as part of the infinite order, which is Ishvara. But it's an infinite person instead of and you see all of an infinite expression of order.
So I accept that I cannot sort of understand this person in totality, but just sort of in parts at various times.
Right, because we only experience in parts, but you still understand it as part of that as an infinite order, and you go on experiencing this infinite order, you know, and learning. You have how the Shastra unfolds it, and you see it all as an expression of infinite knowledge. But then you go on experiencing specifically in your own life this infinite expression of knowledge, and in our experience of the world. So that's how I view. I'm always interested to see how all of these things are playing out, how things unfold, how the creation is unfolding, how the society, how the world is, and the politics, just the whole world, what is going on. I just look at it as Ishwara, and I'm interested to learn about it.
But from a personal perspective, it seems that, I mean, the most natural sort of emotion that, at least what I thought, I mean, that sort of makes sense when you look at it this way, is gratitude, because it seems that then whenever you get something, you think of it as someone is giving it to you. So is that what you
gratitude is that prasad is indeed. Gratitude is a really wonderful emotion. You know, even to have gratitude towards, as a jiva, to have gratitude toward your own body as a temple. You know, to have gratitude toward your mind, toward your sense organs, toward all of the people you know, just toward your life itself. It gives such a peace to the mind. It's a beautiful emotion. I think that's like the prasad of Buddhi.
But if you see all these parts as actually Ishvara, and so they're all gifts from him, or what about when you get pinched, you know, from some of these parts?
When you say gifts, that's a little...
Not gifts, okay, for prasad, you know.
Well, that's why often Swamiji will say, and I think that in this case this word works well, when you see it as an infinite order, you know, infinite order, and that means that sometimes we get pinched, because that's part of the order. When Swamiji said, it was really interesting, there was something that was a little difficult that had happened in his own life,
mm-hmm.
and he said, you know, we always get exactly what we deserve. And it was, I don't know if I can't convey the profundity of that, but to me when he said that, I understood something. That we get exactly, in the huge scheme of things, if you think of it, the whole universe over time and space as an infinite order,
mm-hmm.
right? Then nothing is out of that order. Everything is contained within that order. And so, you said that. I reflect on that. You know, we get what we deserve. It's kind of sobering.
but
it's worthwhile thinking about that. It's complex, right? The world is, the complexity of the world and the order of the world is multidimensional, you know. And so to say, if you have that attitude that we get what we deserve, that's very interesting. Sometimes when he does this, a guided meditation on that, like say something has occurred in your life that is difficult. And then say if you objectify that occurrence and you take and you recognize not just yourself in that occurrence, but all of the different players, the time, the place, and then you kind of take it back, cause effect in time. And then you'll see what has happened as part of a natural result of an infinite order of which you have a little bit of knowledge of. See what I mean? So it's just it's an interesting meditation.
Yeah. The thing about that though is in terms of deserving what one gets, it could be that the causes for whatever this is coming toward me is already not in this lifetime anymore.
Yeah, and it could go, that's right. It
could be like ages ago, where it was.
That's true, but that's right.
But
I'm
even understand why I would receive this, because there's no, in my experience, there it's not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There's no memory of.
I know. That can be. But if you say, if you have that buddhi, at least try it out, it gives an interesting way of being with the world. It, you know, has more to do with responding to the situation rather than reacting against it.
Mm.
It's It's interesting. What are you going to say, Kiki?
Oh. Yeah, because that word prasad, it always, like, it's something from Ishwara, and you go to the temple and you get prasad, and it's never like a scorpion or anything, it's always, you know, something
green.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe the scorpion is more than, you know, trying to understand why this particular thing has come to me.
They're already taking it off, too.
Yeah. Anyway, next up. And then you, yeah.